to be a little bit different today, in the sense that we would normally put a focus on things that are domestic, but we also have to recognize that there are events outside of Barbados that also have a bearing on what happens here. Now, for instance, right now in Barbados, we can safely say that the killings have subsided for some months now, thanks to a truce between warring gangs. At the economic level, the government has been passing its grades with the International Monetary Fund. It has also been passing a lot of legislation. At the same time, the Democratic Labour Party is apparently trying to regroup after 230 love drubbings. But what is happening elsewhere in the region? We're going to bring together some journalists who work elsewhere in the Caribbean to share their perspectives and to answer what questions you may have for them as we try to get a better understanding of the issues and the challenges facing all of us in the Caribbean community. Indeed, one observation I have is that the politicians get together ever so often, but we don't necessarily have that same kind of gathering of regional journalists that we can hear from them on the various matters that are being covered. So with us today, Kemar Jordan, who has worked here in Barbados and in Jamaica, and is now with the Guardian Media Limited in Trinidad. And we also have Javan Johnson out of Jamaica. And we'll soon be joined by Bert Wilkinson from Guyana as well. So let's start with you, Kemar, for your perspective on the main domestic issues in Trinidad at the moment and how you see the regional concerns. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, David. And I have to start by saying you made me sound like an outsider. I'm a Bajan. So you have to start with who's Barbadian and who now lives in Trinidad and worked previously in Jamaica. So I want to start by saying morning, mom. Morning, sis. Good morning to my entire family in Barbados and, of course, the entire Barbados family. So let me start there. In terms of the issues we're facing, as you said, crime is a major concern for the entire Caribbean at this point in time. We just had here in Trinidad two crime summits, in quotation marks. We had the leaders of the Caribbean coming together just a few weeks ago to discuss crime and the solutions. And just last week, the police commissioners from across the Caribbean joined here in Trinidad as well, bringing together that discussion again about crime. The upside of that is that the talks are continuing. There's a lot of talk about collaboration. But the downside of that is that the society, and I mean here the Caribbean society, and in particular the Trinidad society, is very anxious at this point for solutions to crime. Just to paint a picture of what it looks like right away, today we are reporting in the Guardian newspaper that there are 248 murders so far this year. This after a 600 murder toll for the year 2022. So there are almost more murders already for the year than there are days of 2023. And this is a point, a very sore point for the population and indeed for the government. But the issue is that we're not seeing the solutions that we would like. And just to put it comparatively for the listeners as well, and I know Jovan is on the line, so he'll talk more about this, but Jamaica ended last year with 1,498 murders. And when you think of Barbados, that is really huge in terms of murder toll, because we're talking about numbers like 15 murders so far this year. So that's giving you a kind of sense of how it's playing out. And therefore, ultimately, what we're seeing happening in Trinidad in the last couple of weeks and months is that citizens are actually trying to take back their communities. So we're seeing a lot of neighborhood watch programs emerging amid a sense that by the population that the officials are not doing what they need to do and they're not solving the problem. So David, that's the opening in terms of crime as a major concern. Added to that, of course, and affected by that is the economy, which is showing some signs of rebounding after COVID, but at the same time, spluttering a bit because we're not as confident that this economic growth that we're projecting is going to hold and is going to trickle down to the average man. So the economy, and then we'll talk later as well about politics, because that is heating up at the moment based on a Privy Council decision that took place just last week that has everybody now scrambling to get themselves in order for local government elections, a system that Barbados is not accustomed to. We have the general elections, but in countries such as Trinidad and Jamaica, there's also a municipal level of governance. And this is where there's been an extension in Trinidad for a year now, which has been ruled by the Privy Council, which is the highest court in Trinidad, to be unlawful. And as a result, the Prime Minister announced in Parliament late last week that he will be coming to Parliament first of all on Monday to validate the term of the councillors and the aldermen since December, when the extension would have been granted by the government, and then to announce, to be in keeping with the Privy Council ruling, elections by the middle of August, because there's a 3-month window in which he can announce that poll, David.
Yeah, thank you very much for that overview. Javan Johnson out of Jamaica, what do you see as the principal issues dominating particularly the news and the in-depth programs that are being done there?
Thank you very much, David. Good morning. Hi, Kamar.
Good to meet you. Good morning.
Good morning to your listeners. Thank you so much for having me, David. Ah, gosh, our news has been dominated over the last week or so, heading to 2 weeks now, by the salary increases approved for politicians in Jamaica. By that I mean the Prime Minister, Cabinet Ministers, Members of Parliament, and councillors at the local government level. Much of the increase, most of the increases have exceed 200%. And so there is a huge chorus of calls for the government to either roll back the increase or phase it in, or so on. The government has so far maintained the levels of increase, talking about the fact that it's you're aligning incentive with effort and with work, and the debate as well as to whether, you know, should politicians benefit from these kinds of increases that have been given to public sector workers. The broad thing is that there's a public sector compensation restructuring taking place in Jamaica. So the increases to Jamaican politicians is just among the restructuring and reforms taking place when it comes to public sector compensation. And it has been a very contentious issue. As you can imagine, the government is changing the system that has been in place for decades. And there's general agreement from unions and some civil society organizations that it needed to be changed. What we had before were 300 different kinds of pay scales, all kinds of allowances and so on. And so the government is streamlining all of that into 16 bands, 16 pay bands, and assigning workers and so on at different categories to the different bands. The issue with politicians historically in Jamaica have been pegged at one of the highest level paid out to permanent secretaries, who really are the highest paid senior civil servants in the country. And our system says you give $51 more per year above the highest point for a permanent secretary. And when all of that calculation is put in place and so on, then we come to politicians getting 213, 214, 200% increases. And that has been a major issue. So that has been huge. And just coming on today, and then I suspect the news will be shaped by that, is perhaps a regional business tycoon, Lascelles Chin, who founded the Lasco Group of Companies, died overnight. He was 86 years old, huge business figure in Jamaica and in the region. And I won't go back on the issue of security, which has been a major issue for us. The government recently declaring what we call in Jamaica states of public emergency, where the soldiers and so on, where certain constitutional rights are sort of suspended to allow greater rights to the security forces. So those are some of the major issues that we've had.
So for you, Kamar Jordan, when you look at Barbados from Trinidad, what are some of the issues that are coming through to you, some that you may be curious about as well.
I mean, when I look at it, especially the crime concern, the sense is that Barbados is not as bad as where I currently live, Trinidad, in terms of the crime situation, or in Jamaica, where I previously lived. But it still says that there's no room for us to rest on our laurels, because what we're noticing is that the same trends, the same behaviors, the same personalities. For instance, we have to keep a close eye, David, on the age group 15 to 19, which is being blamed, rightfully based on the statistics, for much of the crime that we're seeing across the region. And without looking detailed into the statistics, this is a common concern across the region. We have to be concerned about our young men in particular, but also our young women. There's a new culture that's emerging, and that culture is the bashment culture, as we put it. And with that culture is coming a lot of the behaviors that are associated with crimes. There's also, in terms of the economy, a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, even though we talk about, at the wider level, rebounding economies, and, you know, we're coming out of COVID, we're coming out of the woods, and all of us are projecting economic growth. But the concern has to be that that wealth is not trickling down fast enough. And again, it is spiraling crime. It is spawning crime, whether it be at a wider scale in a Jamaica or a Trinidad, or a smaller scale in Barbados for the moment. So it is not a point for any of us to look on and say, oh gosh, could there, look at them. But we have to be starting to look for the solutions and addressing these basic problems, which tell us that we're more alike than we are different in this Caribbean. And we also have to look at our politics. What is it that's coming out of the mouths of our politicians? What is it, as well, in terms of their actions, that is also hindering or helping crime in the Caribbean to become a concern? Are our politicians keeping a distance from the criminal elements, or are we embracing them in such a way that is becoming problematic for even them to police and to authorize actions against these criminal elements? So this is what, from this distance of, from Barbados right now, looking on with care and concern, it is anxiety sometimes, because I think we get a false sense of hope from the fact that we are not as bad as another territory. And I remember when I was moving to Jamaica, for instance, all my family and friends were saying, oh gosh, you're going to go there to live? We crime real bad. The fact is that you can insulate yourself at some level from crime, but at the same time, the smaller the society, which is what Barbados is, it becomes harder to do that insulation, David. And it means, therefore, that there are lessons for all of us in terms of what is happening, the level at which is happening, and then also the future in terms of what that spells for us as a society. And so, therefore, the issues across the Caribbean are as urgent for Jamaica, Trinidad, as they are for Barbados, whether you're looking at crime, you're looking at economy, or whether you're looking at the politics, because I didn't mention politics in its detail, but there's also a level of polarization that's going on. We are wearing our party colors and we're screaming for one politician versus the other. But in that too, we are recycling one or two parties across the Caribbean. We're not entertaining third parties, really, because that is what we've come to accept. And then, therefore, what does that mean for us in terms of our ultimate governance as a society as well?
Quite a number of issues you have put on the table there. Javon Johnson, this issue of the boys and the men, she mentions 15 ages, 15 to 20, to 19. In some people's mind, it is also going as far as 25. What is happening in that particular arena when it comes to Jamaica's crime situation? And coming out of that, we also want to talk about what is being advanced as possible solutions to the problem.
Yes, thank you, David. It's a very similar situation, and the crime, the intensity may be greater in different countries. Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica having it a lot. Barbados, as Kemar speaks about, the age range of perpetrators and victims is very similar. Just last month, our national security minister gave his sectoral presentation, and he mentioned that the main perpetrators of murder in particular, which is one form of crime, and their victims fall in the age group 25 to 44. And so, for example, in 2022 in Jamaica, 63% of the perpetrators fell within that age range, and 52% of their victims also fell in that range. Very, very, very serious issue. And it speaks to, as one analyst said, you have to go right back to the home. The social intervention measures that have been pursued by government, parenting support, how do you structure education such that you catch the young men before they become unattached, as we call them, and then they are susceptible and vulnerable to being recruited by gang members. And that is the difficulty that we're having. And so it's a solution. I know that a lot of times, you know, politicians are accused of, and in some instances they do, are accused of looking at the issues in silos. So, you know, you look at what you can get done within the electoral cycle, and rather than trying to fundamentally shift things. And as a result of that very short-term mindset, generally speaking, you end up with approaches and responses or solutions that are in silos. So if there are issues in education, there are issues in housing, there are issues when it comes to, you know, the broader economy, poverty and wages and so on. But then the solutions for some are sort of more hard boot police methods where, you know, it's states of emergency, as the debate here in Jamaica is about, or other kinds of hard policing, when other analysts and commentators say that you need to look at the things that don't require more guns and more police men and women on the streets. And those things mean you have to go into the classrooms, the curriculum, the teaching, the affordable meals, for example, the homes, parenting, who are having children. You know, you're able to, we don't have that data, but I'm sure they're able to drill down, for example, to see of these perpetrators in 25 to 14 age range, you know, what is their profile, their family profile? What kind of homes did they come from, or do they come from? So you're
You know, we had a meeting of the regional heads in Trinidad not so long ago. And they were looking at this whole issue of crime. And they talked about treating crime as a public health issue. But to what extent do you all feel that something meaningful came out of that exercise, apart from the controversy that erupted with two prime ministers being criticized for going too far in terms of the remarks against the judiciary? What more could you say came out of that? What do you think, Jovan?
Sorry, David, you're a bit delayed.
Yes, I was asking what you think about what came out of the meeting, the symposium that was held in Trinidad on crime a few weeks ago.
I mean, aside from the signings and so on, what you got, what I think was critical for them, the politicians and so on who participated, was that they wanted a unified voice to say that we are sort of, I don't want to say hamstrung, but they want to pursue particular kinds of measures, but they feel as though the democratic institutions are maybe I'm venturing too far out, but that they are being what they want to pursue, they can't in the way they want to because of the kinds of institutions that we have that will put a check on them and their actions. And in this particular case, the issues with the judiciary, we have had the debate here. We have had a police commissioner who's spoken out about granting bail to persons who they feel don't deserve bail, but then people have a constitutional right to bail. So I think one thing that the conversation, the symposium threw up was the tension between the political directorate and the pressures that come on the political directorate when people don't feel satisfied that crime is being addressed, and how they want to now say that, look, we want to do our work, but then we are being impacted by certain other things. And they have to be careful how they did it. And the Regional Bar Association and so on came out and said that you can't be saying these things and so forth. But what I got from all of them is that they want to do more. I'll give them that in good faith. They want to do more, but then they are sort of constrained. what that does, David, is I think it removes scrutiny from the kinds of policies that they themselves pursue. It removes that kind of scrutiny because you're sort of diverting the attention to, know, in this case, the example is on the judges. But then what is the policy you've been pursuing? Where have the security spending been going? Have you just been talking about you need to tackle crime, you need to do this, you need to do hard, as I mentioned earlier, hard good policing, but show us on the ground and in the communities and in the homes and in the other kinds of sectors, education and health and so on, how you have been trying to address crime in particular ways. And then we can perhaps have a real debate rather than being sidetracked by you saying you're not happy about what the judiciary is doing. When they are functioning according to the law and respecting people's constitutional rights.
Kemar, your thoughts? And just let me remind listeners that you too can participate in this discussion. We've got two other regional journalists here giving us a sense of what's happening in Jamaica, what's happening in Trinidad, what they see as the main issues there. And we too can compare notes and look at what is happening here in Barbados. And ultimately, we're trying to find out too what each country is doing that may be different. Kemar, for instance, in the case of Barbados, this truce between rival gangs is one that we are watching with a great degree of interest. And coming out of all of this, it is pointing us in a direction which may suggest, as has been said by the country's attorney general, that law enforcement alone won't be able to do it. And to some of us, it looks as though law enforcement, as we have been engaging in it, has not been as successful as whatever has been motivating these people in the gangs to lay down their arms for the time being, at least. And it's been quite a while. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are caught in a spiral. And at the same time, there are no easy solutions to crime. Let me put it that way. So to be fair to the authorities, there's no easy crime fix for the Caribbean. I think Jovan touched on it in terms of it has to be an all of society approach to the issues that we're facing in terms of crime. And I think that's what the leaders were trying to get at when they spoke to the crime as a public health emergency and suggesting that we embark on the same strategies that we used for COVID, for instance, where at the individual level, it was your responsibility, for instance, to wear a mask and to support what was happening in terms of the authorities and their programs, et cetera. So,
but did we actually see anything that suggests to us that we were indeed moving in that direction?
No, and that's what I was coming to. So I wanted to start with being generous to the leaders in terms of actually seeing that it requires of all of society approach. The trouble, though, with what has been happening, and I've been covering CARICOM now for 20-something years, and I think where the cynicism sets in is that the leaders continue to talk among themselves, and at the end of the day, we're missing that all of society approach in terms of what we're implementing. Even with the papers that are presented to the leaders, I think we're still missing the beat in terms of what's happening on the ground. We had it here in Trinidad, a new police commissioner who came to office, and she came in recently with a lot of public goodwill behind her. She's one of two female police commissioners in office, and the society actually welcomed her with open arms and said, look, the men haven't been getting this job done, so let's try a woman. Let's see what she can do. And even from the media standpoint, there's been this, you know, seeking to give her a chance to get it done. But the first thing she did was said that she's going to cut crime by June without giving us a clear strategy of how this would happen. And what this has now happened, what has occurred in actual fact, is failure, because there's been no cutting of the crime, especially murder. It has actually increased by 10%.
Before June.
So it has not added to any sort of confidence in terms of the public, in terms of us being able to wrap our minds around this issue. Look, if I'm a child and I'm sitting at home and I'm watching Parliament and I'm seeing the politicians behaving in a rambunctious way, can't collaborate, can't cooperate, is that going to inspire me to go into the straight and narrow? if we as politicians and the persons making decisions continue to highlight and associate with the negatives and the bad and bashment element of the society, is that in itself going to also help us to get to the nitty-gritty? I just saw a very extreme video last night, David. The new president of El Salvador, and I'm not suggesting that this is the way, although having lived in Jamaica and Trinidad and grappling as an editor with not wanting to put crime on the front page every day, and also grappling with the issues in our editorials in terms of what do we need to push for to get this society to change and to look at itself and to make the adjustments. Having done that, seeing a president in El Salvador coming in and taking a very extreme measure where he has actually used the terrorism laws to round up all of the gangsters in the first half of this year into prisons. He built a great big prison and put the gangsters into it. And they've now seen crime move from 200 murders in 1 year to, I think they said one. I might be getting the statistic wrong, but there's been a significant dent in crime owing to that strategy. I'm not saying that that's what we need to adopt wholesale, but this was a leader who didn't just talk the talk. He found a solution to this worrying problem of crime. Now, people from the human rights standpoint have severe issues with the methods that are being used, the methodology in terms of rounding up persons. But there's a sense, I think, in the Caribbean of us surrendering generally to the criminals. And if not only surrendering, also embracing them in a way that does not get the message over that, guys, this is a serious problem that we are tackling, and this is a serious problem that we need to find solutions to. So there's a level of despondency that we have to address in terms of the society. It starts with the leaders, but it does not end with them. And I think even when the leaders are meeting, I think there needs to be a concurrent meeting of the minds in terms of what's happening at all the levels of society for us to really start to see dents in this real problem that we're facing as a society, David.
Well, you know, a lot of this comes right back to the social and cultural, and you've mentioned the bashment a lot. I mean, you've at least twice you've said that that's something that you consider to be a factor in all of this. We're joined here by Bert Wilkinson out of Guyana. He just walked out of church. It's good to see that there are journalists who go to church, and I believe that we can depend upon people like Bert to pray for the rest of us who are not regular churchgoers. But you are also in a country that has been doing quite a lot of praying over the last couple of days, coming out of what has happened at Madia, where this dormitory at this secondary school was burnt, and 19 young people lost their lives. Tell us a little bit about the kind of atmosphere and mood that this has created in Guyana. Good morning, Bert Wilkinson. So you just have to turn on your. I don't think you're hearing me. He's in the car listening, but and very much here, but not enough. So we come back to Bert. Reminder here: 4341790. That's the number for you to call as you participate in this edition of Down to Brass Tacks. The issue here, though, of the culture, the music, the videos, ever so often this is popping up as a major issue. And in Jamaica, Javan, not so long ago, I think that the government came out with a statement that it was cracking down on certain types of lyrics in public spaces. How has that gone? Has that gone anywhere?
Hi, David, yes. It's a good time to check to see whether or not what has been the response to that. But yes, in October last year, the Broadcasting Commission of Jamaica, which is a regulator for broadcast media, issued a directive on what it called songs promoting illegal activity. So things like, you know, Molly, harmful and use, illegal or harmful use of guns or other offensive weapons, jungle justice or any other what they deem to be illegal or criminal, any other activity that they feel, believe are illegal or criminal, those are banned. That created such an uproar because there has been a long-standing tension when it comes to the regulation of, you know, what people call it, the art forms, and to what extent can people use their art to criticize or to comment on societal happenings. We've not heard from the BCJ as to whether they've had to take any enforcement action against any of the regulated entities who they feel breached this this thing. But the broader issue, again, for some, the actions of the BCJ bordered on, if not they feel, is a breach of people's rights to freedom of expression, and also your freedom to receive information as well. And that bit did go on for quite a while. But they, again, and it also resurrected another debate, including comments from our Prime Minister, former Ministers of National Security, about, you know, certain kinds of music in dancehall, if you can't escape it in this particular instance, about, you know, promoting gangsterism, badmanism, and so on. And the question is always, aside from the issue of freedom of expression and so on, is always, why do the authorities sort of pick on these things when there are fundamental issues in the society that they need to address? And so that continues to be a debate. But in light of your question, it's a good time to ask the Broadcasting Commission to give us an update as to how...
I wonder the degree to which people at the popular level believe that there's been any change, because one, people must be able to determine that based upon what they're hearing when they go to certain events, when they listen to the radio stations. Has there been any real change?
It's hard to say. It's very difficult to say. It's very difficult to say. The other thing is, you have to also look at consumption patterns. How are Jamaicans consuming music? And are they consuming music and the particular kinds of music that the regulator is targeting via the means, via the regulated forms? So the BCJ does not regulate internet, the internet, and or young people are the younger generation is consuming music and other kinds of content and so on through all kinds of different means, through music applications and so on that are not necessarily regulated. That are not regulated by the Broadcasting Commission. So there's also that.
Right. Bert Wilkinson, I think you can hear us now. So I want you to give me some sense of the mood in Guyana arising from this fire at Madia. And beyond that, we want to then look at some of the other major issues that are being discussed in that country at the moment. So let's deal with the aftermath of the fire in the first instance.
Good morning to everyone. Let me start by saying that even as we mourn the loss of 18 girls, teenage girls, and a 5-year-old boy, we're all sitting here, waiting here, and hoping that nothing happens of a similar nature at the prisons, or any juvenile detention center, or any police lockups or anywhere, because let me tell you something, nothing has changed. And we all sit here and we fear that if there's a fire at any one of those places, iron grilled and barbed wired and all that, and you know, one person with a bunch of keys, and that person's gone to the shop across the road, or just ran to town for something, it could happen again. Nothing has changed. And that's the depressing thing about what's happened in Guyana.
Is it safety, the safety issues?
Is safety awareness? Zero. It's always some one man, one station sergeant with the keys, and he's gone out, he's gone to court to give evidence, or the house matron is not there, she ran home to look after the rest of her kids, something like that.
You were recalling an earlier incident. You were making reference to something else that had happened before this one, before this particular matter at Madia. I think we've lost contact with Bert, so we'll come back to him.
I'm hearing you.
Good. Yes. Uh-huh. So I'd asked you to spell out what exactly you were about to refer to when you were saying, well, you know, this situation could happen again, but you seem to be on the verge of saying that it had happened before.
Yes. In 2016, I think we're just around May, just around now, there was a fire at the main Georgetown prisons. You may remember that. Prisoners set fire to mattresses and other facilities, protesting a whole heap of woes, including overcrowding and trial delays. 17 died. There was a slew of recommendations from the Commissioner of Inquiry. Nothing is implemented. And look what happened again. In 2008, three indigenous children died in a fire in the interior, not too far from Madia. So, you know, every now and then it's going to happen. I went to a detention center, juvenile detention center, just east of the city on Monday morning. I was so depressed about what happened at Madia. I took a photograph of a juvenile detention center. There is no way in an emergency and in a case of panic that these children could get out of such a situation. I posted it on Facebook, 1,000,000 comments. Nothing has happened. No one called to say, hey, you know, it made sense or it didn't make sense. So those are the fears we're living with, even as we mourn.
What are some of the other major issues that people in Guyana have been talking about?
The ad hocness of government of governance. There is no, we're not working to any major development plan. And after 2050, when Exxon discovered oil, the country is being led by oil and gas, big oil and gas, you know. We're under pressure to keep up. We're under pressure to provide support facilities, onshore facilities for oil and gas. We're under pressure to update legislation. We're under pressure to train locals. So that's the other big thing in Guyana, trying to keep up with oil and gas. This Stabroek Block is perhaps maybe the most prolific in the world. And for generations, for every 10 wells they drill, they find 9, they find 8. So we are about now to become, start producing in another 2 years, 1,000,000 barrels a day. In the context of CARICOM, that's astonishing. But yet, because...
Yeah, go ahead. So how has that...
Are you hearing me? Am I still
here? I'm hearing you still. How has that changed life for the people of Guyana?
There is opportunity for people with money, because oil is big business. Downstreaming, there is opportunity for apartment buildings, for supply, and the supply chain for foodstuff and other stuff, things with the rigs and the drill ships. But I don't think enough people in Guyana have come together to form consortiums so that they could garner enough resources to keep up with the demands of oil and gas. There's 6 drill ships right now, what we call FPSOs, the storage tankers from which oil ships come and take away their supplies. So you have more than 1,000 people out there who need to eat, who need to drink, who need medicine. And if we want to take advantage of local content opportunities and laws, most people, you have to come together in consortiums because it's big money.
To what degree have you seen people coming into Guyana to take advantage of these opportunities? People, especially from other CARICOM countries.
Well, as you can expect, you know, Trinidad had more than 100 years of experience in oil and gas, and the Trinidadians are filling up. They're here by the thousands already, and Ghana needs them, and people don't mind. They sound like us, and they eat the same things, and they lime like us. So we don't consider them foreigners in any way. But there's opportunity for other CARICOM nationals, but I haven't seen even the previous government or the current government reaching out enough to the Caribbean. Guyana has an employment problem. Diana has opportunities for skills that we wouldn't fill without help for maybe for another decade.
Your other colleagues here have been identifying social problems, especially crime, as a major headache for some. Guyana doesn't seem to have as big a problem as we have in Jamaica, Trinidad, St. Lucia. What seems to be the key to your ability?
Guyana is an interesting place when it comes to crime, serious crime, felonies, etc. We may have 115, 120 murders a year, and you have to believe what I'm going to tell you now. The majority of those murders would be, for example, domestic violence. Husband killing wife, wife killing husband. The second most important, and the second highest category for that, what we call disorderly conduct. You know, Guyana is a South American country with an interior, they mine for gold and diamond. When the guys come out from the back down, they drink up on the landing and they kill each other. That's the number two. But the other area of concern for Guyana, petty crime, snatching cell phones. I've seen burglaries have gone down. People don't jump houses anymore. But the petty crime, snatching a gold chain, snatching the and fraud, white collar crime.
Your link has gone again. I think you need to get to a Wi-Fi link that is stronger. So let's see if you can do that. And in the meantime, just let me remind you that this Brass Tack Sunday is looking today at the whole question of regional events and getting the views of some of the Caribbean's journalists. We have with us KMR Jordan, who reminds us by accent and explicitly that she is a Barbadian who lives in Jamaica, in Trinidad at the moment, has lived in Jamaica, worked there in both countries, and Javan Johnson out of Jamaica, and also Bert Wilkinson, a journalist in Guyana. This is Brass Tack Sunday. Now, KMR Jordan, you are one of the people in regional journalism who have been really concerned about regionalism. And therefore, I want to get your take on what progress, if any, you have seen in that regard. Because you hear about Guyana's economic thrust, the significant improvement that has been taking place there, while at the same time, other economies have been having some real difficulties, even though they have rebounded somewhat from the COVID pandemic. What are your thoughts?
David, you're right. I'm an unrepentant regionalist. Spent, as I said, over 20 years through CANA, CMC, traveling the region and covering a lot of summits and also getting to know the Caribbean very personally, so that's why I feel comfortable being able to move from one country to another. With that, though, has come a lot of disappointment, because I think that we are a shadow of what we should be in terms of a Caribbean, in terms of our progress, in terms of our own understanding of each other and our culture, and ultimately in terms of a force, in terms of a united force on the global stage. That was the expectation of regionalism and the CARICOM experiment, which has grown over in terms of the number of years. But sadly, the level of progress that we would expect at this point in terms of the movement is not being seen today.
What so would you have been looking for?
For instance, even this question, I mean, Bert touched on it, of us being able to see the Caribbean as our oyster. There's still too much, you know, a foreigner. I hate that word, to be honest with you, as a Caribbean national. Foreigner taking up a job in my country, whether it be in the oil and gas or the media or politics or whatever. We really have to move to the level in this Caribbean, if we're going to progress, of looking for the very best talent wherever it is in this Caribbean and being able to celebrate it and to use it to our advantage as a region. And I don't think that we have moved as a people to that level of maturity in terms of seeing that. So we're still very we're still very nationalistic in our view, even if regionally, there are a lot of benefits to be had. So that's at one level. In terms of the economic, and as I said, COVID was a good example. We would have thought that in the midst of crisis comes the best of us in terms of cooperation. And this is what makes it a little bit disheartening, because during COVID, we kind of recoiled. There were some bright lights in that development where we say, for instance, Barbados at one point taking in some Trinidad nationals that were stranded, but we kind of all recoiled and kind of like break for ourselves in the midst of crisis and not seeing where there could have been greater cooperation. We spoke about a CARICOM bubble in terms of words, but that never materialized in terms of anything to carry our economies forward in the midst of crisis. And I think that was a lost opportunity for us. And the same thing with crime again. I don't want to sound like I'm dwelling on crime, but again, this is issue number one for a lot of our countries right now. And there's a lot of long talk taking place, but there's no concrete action, whether it be at the political level or at the people level, that says to us that we are really going to grab this issue by the horn and be able to slay this dragon that is affecting all of us. So we're not learning. I don't think we're taking the best examples from each other in terms of what there is to resolve the issues that we're facing. So for me, as an unrepentant Caribbean national, we even see it in terms of the movement of people. This is something that we've been talking about ad infinitum, but the movement of people is still very difficult in terms of moving from one Caribbean country to another. And there are different levels of acceptance of even the CARICOM skill national certificate, which was agreed to and signed off by all of our leaders many, many moons ago. So I am a disappointed CARICOM national, but I'm not without hope. I'm not speaking as one without hope. I still feel that, you know, that with the right political will, the right people will as well, that we could move forward more forcefully and powerfully in terms of this region, David.
Hey, Jovan, your comment, bearing in mind also that you have to leave at midday. So when you look at this whole regional integration process from Jamaica, what are you seeing?
Well, I endorse pretty much all of what Kamara just said. I know that the tendency is to focus on the big three or four, Guyana, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, and Jamaica. And perhaps of all of them, Jamaica has been more of a CARICOM skeptic, if you will. But certainly when the Labour administration is in power, or the Labour Party is in power, which has historically had a much more skeptical orientation towards CARICOM. But then that sort of changed a bit when the former doubter, if you wish, Bruce Golding, he headed a CARICOM review commission that the current prime minister set up early in his first term, well, in his term after winning the elections in 2016. And the argument was that, you know, there are benefits, but then, you know, you sort of had to, if certain things don't happen by a certain time, then we Jamaica probably sees way out of it. But the prime minister after that committed himself to CARICOM. And one of the biggest displays of that, which was a huge question sign, is the extent to which Jamaica is going to take steps to go towards the Caribbean Court of Justice in its appellate jurisdiction. We still, of course, have the Privy Council as our final court of appeal. And it's interesting because right now Jamaica is undergoing a process of constitutional reform. And the government has said that in the early stages of that reform, the CCJ issue is not on the agenda because there's no consensus. Now, the opposition, People's National Party, has long supported it. And today you may even look at a Gleaner editorial that is on the issue of the CCJ. And the government continues to appear very cold or cool on it. And that is, in essence, highlights the attitudes, at least at officialdom in the establishment from the ruling party towards CARICOM-related issues. I know in relation to the issue of the private sector, that has always been a long thing, that Jamaica is not the idea is that we're not, our companies are not being treated fairly in other countries. Then there's also the issue of the free movement matter that was significantly addressed by the Shanique Myrie case, which of course you will recall. And then I know CARICOM established a private sector, the CARICOM private sector group there as a way to get to bring the minds together and to address some of the issues. And if you realize you've not been hearing a lot of that, issues about unfair terms of trade and so on, doesn't mean that those issues are all resolved. But I think with the creation of that mechanism, that there becomes some formal structure through which a lot of these issues can be ventilated.
But of course, one of the things that I'd like to get your reaction to is the fact that Barbados and Guyana are making a lot of their food production efforts. Is this something that is going unnoticed in Jamaica?
Absolutely not at all. Absolutely not. And I know that our Minister of Industry, Investment and Commerce, Senator Aubin Hill, even visited Guyana, I think, about a month or so ago as part of I suppose, the efforts to bring the countries closer, to pursue arrangements for trade. Energy is obviously a major thing, and Guyana is now emerging.
But it sounds bilateral. It makes it sound as though this is being pursued, Barbados, Guyana, Jamaica, Guyana, rather than within the framework of a regional food security effort. That's how it's coming across. What do you think?
That is exactly how it is coming across. Because I think the countries sometimes, you know, the insularity in wanting to lock in benefits for themselves and not looking at the bigger picture. And that may be an issue that goes to what Kemar talked about, the issue of political will, to create the kind of environment where terms of trade and issues and all of these kinds of things can be sorted out at a macro regional level. And then from that flow, the bilateral arrangements that countries can pursue and do pursue among each other. So there is work to be done, because how we target issues or how we try to address issues, pretty much country to country, and then you say, okay, let us see what we can do at the regional level, and perhaps maybe a different approach would anchor CARICOM more.
Well, Jovan, let me thank you very much for joining us and giving us of your time. You have another commitment that you must take care of, and therefore you have helped to give us a sense of what's happening in Jamaica at the moment, and also your perspective on the regional effort that we continue to embark upon here in the Caribbean. So thanks again.
Thank you very much, David. Bye, Kemar.
Fine. We stay with Kemar Jordan and Bert Wilkinson. And surely, what we've done so far today is to basically bring people from who are watching the situation in other Caribbean countries together. What I'd like you to, as members of the public, to discuss with us is what you see coming out of this kind of exercise as it relates to what are the common issues, the common challenges. I can tell you that surely this matter of how we respond to crime in the Caribbean looms large. I hear elements of what we are discussing here in Barbados. And Barbados is into what the Prime Minister is describing right now as mission transformation. Whether that's just a buzzword or will actually produce meaningful change, I suppose over a reasonable time frame, is left to be seen. One of the big problems we face, and I listened to the Prime Minister of Jamaica speak about it in Jamaica as well this week, it has to do with the ability to implement things. He spoke about this implementation deficit. And it is in that context that he was saying that there was a need to bring about change in the public service of Jamaica, because everybody in Jamaica seems to be of the view that some people believe that the longer sometimes you take to do something, the more that reflects that it is well done. Of course, in the case of Barbados, the criticism is on the other side of that we're doing so much and it seems as though we're trying to do too many things at one time too quickly. So those are some of the issues that we see, you know, coming at us when we listen to what is happening in other Caribbean countries. This local government election in Trinidad, because we do not have a system like that here in Barbados, KMR, explain to people who are unfamiliar with it exactly how it works in relation to the broader national election.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just as in Barbados, there is a 5-year cycle of elections that can also be amended based on the will of the Prime Minister in terms of calling an election early. There's a general election process in Trinidad and Tobago. In addition to that, there is, just as the name suggests, a local system which allows more intimate governance arrangement. And that is what we refer to in terms of the local government elections. This period of a term of this structure is a 3-year term, though, not a 5-year term, is a 3-year term. And what occurred in Trinidad within the last year, last December, was that the government pretty much said, look, there's a need for some reform of this system. There have been complaints that the system was not quite working in the way it was intended. So in terms of the decision-making, the structure, the issues that people are raising, even in terms of garbage collection, et cetera, that they're not getting the type of results that they expect from the local government system, which is made up of councillors and aldermen. So what would have happened in the last year was that the government actually went to Parliament and was granted an extension of the term, the 3-year term, by 1 year. That was, however, challenged at the level of the Privy Council. And the decision on that challenge, after going through the lower court, the high court, the court system in Trinidad, it was referred to the Privy Council. And the Privy Council ruled that that extension of an additional year was unlawful. Therefore, the government, in seeking to honor that ruling by the Privy Council, which came down on May 18, is now putting in place the necessary arrangements for there to be a local government poll, which must be held now within 3 months of the declaration of there being an election. And the Prime Minister is saying that he will go to Parliament first on Monday, which is tomorrow, to validate the actions that were taken by those councillors and aldermen between December 2022 and May 18, when the Privy Council made its ruling, so that there's no question that those were valid actions. And then once that legitimacy is given to those actions, that he will now proceed to honor the decision of the Privy Council in terms of calling an election as soon as possible. So we are awaiting a final election date. But what we do know at the moment is that elections, local government elections, not general elections, will be held in Trinidad and Tobago. Well, Tobago doesn't, it doesn't apply to Tobago, in Trinidad, before the 17th of August this year, David.
Watching this system play out in Trinidad, what are your thoughts as Barbados itself considers a form of local governance?
I mean, again, having experienced local government in Trinidad, experienced it as well in Jamaica up front, it begs the question whether we really do need another system of government. Is another layer is meant to make it more personal and personable in terms of the responses of the authorities. But sadly, if you poll, which we did just last week here in Trinidad, people here in terms of number one, whether they felt that the system was working for them and they were satisfied, the answer was a resounding no. We also polled people this last week in terms of, do you know who your counselor is? And it was, again, surprising that many people didn't even know who their counselor was. And then the other question now is, will you be voting in local government elections? And what we're seeing reflected is that a level of apathy that has been very noticeable at the general elections level is also translating into the local government election level. So therefore, it really begs the question, whether the system is effective, not whether it's needed, but whether it is effective. Because I think any effort to personalize the governance and to make it more relevant should be touted. But at the same time, how it has actually been implemented and the effectiveness of the arrangement is, I think, currently where we're having the issues, David.
Oh, okay. Bert Wilkinson from Guyana. What do you think? I don't know if you're having problems hearing us still. This person says, because I've got a couple of responses here from people. This person says that government banning vulgar music, a music that promotes crime from radio, is good. But allowing the people to basically sing and perform these songs on stage, plus on the internet, the person presents this as a pretty challenging situation facing us. Another person says crime, all types, is generally a family business for those involved. The criminals are generally protected by family members and their community. Criminals and criminal activities thrive in communities and facilitate some of the needs and wants of those in the community.
Yeah.
That the government and the wider society have failed or refused to provide. Yeah. Now that reminds me of comments which have been made by the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. The last couple of days, he was remarking that crime is a business.
Yeah.
And that what he was again lamenting was what he described as this revolving door, where the police will apprehend people, take them to court, and then they're out on bail for serious offenses. And then they get back to the community where they are intimidating people by their criminal behavior. So, I mean, it is not far removed from the comments which had been made at the symposium by the prime ministers of Barbados and St. Vincent. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the Prime Minister of Trinidad likes to say, if you see something, say something. And I think politicians are saying the right things, but they're not necessarily always, and this is not a Trinidad comment, they're not necessarily always doing the right things. And the same thing occurs at the individual level. You know, we say the right things. When the crime takes place and it doesn't hit our household, if there's no person involved with us, we want all of the information. We can be very, you know, we can be very detailed in terms of wanting to know, etc. But then when it hits home, it is a completely different thing. And we see the politicians behaving just like the society in terms of how they treat to crime. One of the things that has stunned me traveling around the Caribbean is that we have gangsters getting legitimate state contracts in territories. So again, if the message is going to be going out that we are not in any way supporting crime, or that we abhor crime and we want crime to stop, how could it be that the criminal element be holding official state contracts in our territories? So the message has to be consistent in terms of what we're saying and also what we're doing. If as a parent, we're saying we are upset about crime, we can't be encouraging our children to participate or to bring home the proceeds of any criminal act or to be, you know, indulging in criminal behavior. So it calls for introspection at the individual, at the community, and at the national level and governmental level in terms of us resolving this issue of crime, David. But I think, as I said, when it doesn't hit home, we can give all the analysis, we can give all of the solutions. But when it is personal to us and when we ourselves need to act in terms of what we're doing, it becomes problematic. I love music. I love the Caribbean culture. But, and I've said it twice here, I have nothing against, I love all types of music. But there is a problem when the majority of our young people, or a large portion of our young people, are consistently feeding themselves with a diet of gun lyrics and criminal lyrics, because ultimately you are what you eat. So it is going to come out at some level in terms of how you communicate with your peers, and it might not be to the level of actually lifting a gun and doing something as awful as shooting another individual, but it starts sometimes in terms of your verbal discourse. And that's why I worry about Barbados as much as I worry about Trinidad, where I am right now, because as I said, we get a false sense of security that because the murders haven't occurred yet, at the level that it is occurring in other territories, that we are insulated. But we are seeing all of the negative signs that will one day make us jump up and say, oh my gosh, it's too late for us as well in terms of what is happening now in our society. So I think this is the real discussion that we need to have. And as I said, let's start with ourselves, because it's easy to point the finger at somebody else, but let's start with ourselves in terms of what we're doing in our households and in our communities, who we know, the people we know in our society, in our communities, who are off track right this minute. But we are just like, oh, don't mind him. Or we're just allowing it because some of us are also benefiting from that culture. But we have to address it because that's how the monster is fed, David.
Well, this whole question of the relationship between politicians and...
And David, are you hearing me now?
Yes, I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you. To what extent are you seeing that link in Guyana, the link between the political class and the criminal class? Is that an issue there, Bert? The question is whether you're seeing, because you're breaking up quite a bit. Your particular line is not good at all. You can try to answer the question and let's see if that's coming through.
I think I heard you ask about a link between the politicians and a political class and a criminal class, something like that?
Correct. That's correct, because that's a point which was raised earlier by Keir Maher. I think, though, we don't have...
In Ghana right now, there was discussion just this week with the European Union about electoral reform. And one of the points that came up had to do with campaign financing. And, you know, the improvement of... the need to improve the systems related to campaign financing. Lo and behold, I opened the papers today and I saw Vice President Jagdeo saying, hey, we don't mind doing that. But it's going to expose who our financiers are. And knowing Guyana, we know very well that the criminal underworld, the narco underworld, those are the smugglers, they finance both of the major parties, particularly the current incumbent governing People's Progressive Party. So there is a concern that, yes, there is a link between
Well, the question is, how do you see that link on the ground? I can tell you years ago, in covering an election here, we saw a particular trend which has really grown on election day. And from all that you hear, the involvement of the politicians and the people who are considered by some to be the undesirables, that link seems to have grown over the years. Now, will the issue of campaign financing and the calls that have been made over the years for us to do away with the current system, will this actually make a difference? I mean, people find ways and means of trying to get around the system. What we have to look at, though, and I think Jamaica gave us the example of Dr. Skok and Tivoli Gardens, what we have to look at is the growth of it. It is one thing to look at it as it is today, but where will it be 30 years, 40 years from now? To what extent does that bother you, Kemar? Because we're having real difficulty hearing Wilkinson. Yes.
No, and David, that's exactly my concern. As I said, you know, we tend to operate in the moment. And the moment as it is worrying in terms of the crime situation across the region. And it's all interlinked. So we talk about the economy and we talk about politics. All everything is interwoven. And the as I said, that gap earlier between the haves and the have-nots, those who feel they have not feel they have to take from the haves. Yeah. And there's that level of what's the word? Disenchantment and resentment that is growing within our society. We used to boast in Barbados of having a very strong middle class. There's been a lot of taxation placed on the middle class to the point where now we're talking about the working poor in many instances. And with that disenchantment among the working poor, there is this current that fuels a lot of the criminal or the non-desirable behavior that we're seeing emerging within our society. And I think this is something that we have to be very guarded against. And as I said also, I mean, I come from a Christian background. I'm not saying that everybody, if you're not a Christian, that is not what that you know, you have no place. That's not what I'm saying, because we're now very liberal in terms of our religion and religious practices. But also too, David, we have to come to terms with the fact that our society has changed and move away from what we traditionally found to be the principles of society that also grounded many of us. And you made the point earlier about Bert going to church. Many of us don't even go to any place of worship or don't have a spiritual grounding. So within the context of a society that's not only changing from the standpoint of the income structure, but also changing from the standpoint of what we hold dear in terms of our purpose and our principles, this is where I think we have a problem. As society become more and more individualistic and we're going after our own thing, you know, that disconnects us from the sense of community and the sense of family. And all of these elements come together to put us where we are in 2023, but also paints a picture of what we need to be wary of when we look, as you said, down to 20, 30 years from now as a society and what we'll be faced with. And I am hopeful that somehow that in the midst of all the liberalism, that this still can be something that is coming out that save us from going down a bad road, because there are some bright lights from the liberalism, but we have to be able, in the midst of all of the changes that we are going through as a society, to safeguard those things that protect us from the negative aspects of our development, David.
Well, there's some other developments as well. Something is happening.
Before you go, David, tell me if you're hearing me clearly now.
I'm hearing you clearly now, yes, Bert. The question is whether you're hearing me as well, because it sounds as though you're going and coming. So one of the other developments that we have here, you may be seeing a video that is circulating in the United States about Target losing
$9 billion. Yes, I was just wondering with Kmar and you, regional veteran.
Go ahead. There seems to be a delay between us, and therefore you're hearing me much later after I've spoken. So I would say that Target has lost $9 billion in a week following boycott calls over LGBTQ-friendly kids' clothing. Here, there is a simmering mistrust of what is going on the ground, because they fear that the multilateral agencies and companies, agencies that are led by the United States, Canada, and the Europeans are forcing certain things upon us as Caribbean countries. And a greater acceptance of the LGBTQ concept is something that is troubling some people. There are people who are not troubled by it, because you know there are these two camps. I don't know to what extent you are picking this up in Trinidad. The other one that is very strong is this move towards digitization, it's as if you just cannot avoid having to go in that direction, even though you don't feel as though you are adequately prepared for dealing with it, with all the hacking and intrusion that goes with it. And apart from crime, to what extent are these issues being discussed in Trinidad?
Yeah. I mean, on the LGBTQ, just last week, there were calls from the LGBTQ community for more laws to protect them. The sense on the ground is that, you know, we are all open to express ourselves in terms of what it is that we feel, what we believe, but some people are more open or more are allowed to be more expressive than others. So the LGBTQ have been seeking to have greater equality and have a greater voice in terms of their own feelings, emotions, etc. And that's, to me, well and good and part of a liberal society. What is important, though, is that I think every society needs to define itself ultimately, David. And I think this is where our leaders are not leading. I think in the quest to make everybody happy, we're not saying what, for instance, what is it that Barbados stands for? When you see a Barbadian or you hear a Barbadian speaking globally, what is it that we can say that unites us in terms of what we believe in? You know, and I think that is something that even in the midst of all the development plans we're developing and the transformation we're doing, we need to be clear in terms of what that is. And I think when a society is clear on who it is, it allows it to fashion its individuals and each, and is a message that has to translate right down to the smallest child and up to the biggest adult in terms of what it is that being Barbadian means, what is it that being Trinidadian means. The second part you mentioned in terms of digitization,
yes,
it's something that we've had to embrace. We can't run away from it. Right now, I lead a newsroom which has had to adopt a digital first strategy. We still make the majority of our money from the traditional media in terms of newspaper and television. It's a one newsroom. But at the same time, we've had to invest time and effort into a digital strategy because we realize that this is meeting the public where the public is. And right now, everyone in our society, whether you're in Barbados or Trinidad or whatever, David, might even be more people listening to us on Brass Stats via smartphones around the world than there are people tuned into the traditional radio station. That's just the reality of the day. And what is meant for media is the same thing that is meant for other industries, which is that you don't have time to sit down and cry for yourself or say, well, you know, we weren't even prepared for it. You have to get prepared and you have to participate in this arena because the society is not going to turn back. At the same time, I don't think the traditional media, if I stick on the media, is dead or is on its last legs. There are people who are of our generation, David, and the generations maybe even a little younger than ours that still were brought up into the environment of traditional media. So they still, for the time being, for the next 30, 40 years or so, they will still be able to relate to the traditional environment. But what we are having to do as media and what we're having to do as other industries is to adapt to the fact that we're now finding bigger audiences, fleeting as they may be sometimes in terms of their attention span, who are consuming and are part of the future that is now. So that is the challenge of digital, but it's also the opportunity of digital. And it is for us to establish ourselves and at the same time in establishing ourselves to keep true to the principles, David, of what it is we've established in the traditional arena, because it's like the same thing we're talking about crime and what's not. If we don't have a principle to take us into the digital world, we're going to find ourselves behaving like the bloggers and those who just are there for a different agenda. So it's, to me, in everything that's happening, whether it is with the changes to the society or to in terms of the traditional society or the new society in terms of digitization, it really comes down to principles and purpose whenever you're engaging in those arena.
David. This person wrote to say that we've dealt with the link between the political class and the criminal element. But what about the link between the political class and the journalists? Are the members of the panel seeing a type of journalism that mirrors the narrative of the government, a tempering of negative news and hyping the positive, with no real analysis of government policies, especially those that find little favor with the populace? And the person goes on to say that the main words used in reporting these days are that people are pleased, happy, and satisfied. Mm-hmm. What is being done to raise the quality of journalism mm-hmm. and to keep out the political class? Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting one because, you know, there has always been a kind of touch and go relationship between politicians and journalists who have been involved in questioning the decisions and the positions that are adopted by journalists. Indeed, my own experience over the years has said that you have to fight against politicians trying to turn you into their public relations arm. And if they can't get you to function like that, they can at times be quite abusive to you and put people to curse you too. So, you know, we've been there. But the question for you is, how do you see this evolving? It's one thing to talk about going digital, but if you don't hold on to certain aspects of the principles, as you said, you could still find yourself being classified as being just a government mouthpiece.
Yeah, I think the key here is there's a big difference between a journalist and a political activist. And I think that those definitions have to be made clear in the minds of not just the politicians, but more importantly, in the minds of the practitioners. And when I say practitioners here, it goes from the level of the reporter to the editor to the media owner. And I think if we could keep those definitions clear, David, I think we would be fine going forward. The trouble is, it takes guts. It takes enduring a lot of threats, not only verbal threats of abuse, but verbal threats of death. I've endured those in my own media career. And it also takes, even for women, you have to have a level of cojones, you know, you have to be able to stand up for what you believe in. And that doesn't always end up with you remaining where you are in terms of the media house that you practice your craft, because sometimes it can get very, 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 very treacherous. But ultimately, you have to be able to stand true to principles. And I want to add that it is not only the political class as well, it is also the corporate class. Because what people forget often is that advertising, for instance, pays for newspapers to be published, and similarly for other media houses to thrive. The reason why you're behind a microphone today, David, is because there are revenues coming into your institution. And what we find in the media world is that you're not only fighting against the political class, and that's a tough fight to tell a prime minister no, and it's not about disrespect, but it is in terms of standing up for principle. I've had to say to a few politicians, run your office, please, respectfully, and let me run mine. But that takes a lot. And even when you say that as a journalist, you need to be emboldened as well by, as I said, your owners, because there's a lot of crybaby behavior at the high level, whether it's corporate or political, going to who they think is going to make you run away from your principles. So it's a tough and treacherous area. It's something I'm very passionate about. It's something that I've been burnt by.
I'm going to take a break here and come back in about 5 minutes or so. This is Down to Brass Tacks. So this Brass Tacks Sunday, we're looking at regional events and getting the views of some of the Caribbean's journalists. We've been hearing from KMR Jordan, who's in Trinidad, Bert Wilkinson in Guyana. We heard also from Javon Johnson in Jamaica. And now we are joined by Earl Bousquet in St. Lucia. He really got late notice of what we were doing. But we wanted to get the perspective also from somebody who's been working in St. Lucia over the years. I mean, last year, St. Lucia had about 70, 71 murders. This year, you've had to call in the RSS. And one of the concerns raised in this program is that crime remains so dominant an issue within the region. And the factors and the forces that are at work there, this program has identified boys between 15 and 25 as being at the center of a lot of it, whether you're talking about Jamaica, Barbados, or Trinidad. Some people believe that this, the so-called bashment culture and some aspects of the music, the link between politicians and the criminal element has also been identified as a factor that is helping to harden the situation. From St. Lucia, how do you see it, Urubuske? You got to turn on your mic. Your mic is off. Yes.
Are we there now?
You are.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. Never mind, I've had to wait 20 minutes to speak for about five. I've got to go in about 7 minutes' time. The crime situation is one I've been writing about for quite some time. The biggest news in St. Lucia since the crime situation has been the rate at which seasoned journalists are going away. Your namesake, Guy Ellis, after 60 years in journalism, departed just recently. And just this past week, Winston Springer also departed. And what we are having is that in both of these cases, you've had a veteran journalist like myself. I've been doing the same thing every day for the last 47 years across the Caribbean. And the one thing that is quite common in all of these cases is how we cover crime, how we deal with crime. And I've always held that as long as we cover crime as a news event and not as a social reality, as long as our coverage of crime continues to be, I don't know for Barbados and elsewhere, but historically the coverage of crime has been from the standpoint of comparing from year to year which year has had more deaths and more homicides when elections are
just approaching. Bert, hold on a minute. Bert, I think you got to silence your mic because too much of the background noise is coming through, including your attempt to reverse the car. Yes, Earl.
Yeah, that as long as we continue to cover crime as an event, as a news headline, as something that we have to report on, then what we do is that we fall into the trap of the general public perception that crime is something that governments and parties can either end, bring under control, or sufficiently manage to bring about enough public confidence. And none of the above is possible until such time as we as journalists see crime not only as an issue worth reporting, but something, a societal reality that came before us, that will stay while we're here, that will go after. And therefore we have to look at institutionalizing our approaches to crime. We report on crime. How many of us go to the source of the crime? We would go to the victims, the mothers, to ask them how they feel about their sons or daughters having died that way. But how much, or do we ever try to go to find the persons who either are accused or who would be the persons who have been accused before, to find out what goes into the mind of a criminal, what drives a criminal to be a criminal? These are some of the societal issues, and I think the most controversial position I've taken on this, and it is only controversial because those who replied were only responding to what they heard, but not trying to look beyond it. And I said, listen, crime cannot be gotten rid of. Because just consider, if we get rid of crime, what are we going to do with the police, the lawyers, the prisons, the correctional officers, and the entire system, including the judicial system? What are we going to do with the system that is built around crime if we get rid of crime?
I think people are particularly concerned, though, about violent crime. That causes the greatest alarm within these societies. The shootings, for instance, and the fear that goes with shootings. I think in the case of what happened there now in St. Lucia recently, where the RSS had to be brought in to try to curb the situation, it was driven by the number of murders and shootings.
Yes, and this was not the first time. There's been there's always a historical pattern. There's always a history to anything. And it so happens that the RSS was called in this time. There was a worse period of crime when the state intervened by launching a police operation called Operation Restore Confidence that did not bring results, just as much as one cannot say that the bringing here of the RSS has ended violent crime, because people continue to die from violence, maybe not at the rate that has put us in the headlines. So I'm not trying to downplay or underplay the issue of violent crime, but violent crime has always been with us, to the extent that what is happening now is that as a result of Caribbean societies, particularly within the Commonwealth, having had to, over the past 20 years, I would say the past two decades, adopt the political correctness of the Europeans insofar as how to deal with capital crime, the whole issue of hanging, as we call it, as it is, hanging, that is a discussion that is coming back, because we all supported, yes, well, it is inhumane. Now, when it comes to violent crime, The call now, including from prime ministers, is why don't we go back to hanging? So these sort of knee-jerk responses to levels of crime will not pay, because no police, judge, or any society will be able to determine when and how somebody is going to take a decision to carry out a violent act. When that is done, it is then that the society begins to react to what has happened. But what we need to be able to do is to take a permanent, consistent approach to assessing crime and finding the solutions to not ending crime, but to handling it in a way that it will discourage those who commit crime and we're talking about violent crime, it will discourage those who commit violent crime from wanting to act. But the general view is that in the Caribbean's effort to become politically correct by European standards, the one thing that the society felt was sufficiently, and I think that was wrong insofar as feeling that hanging is enough of a deterrence. I don't think hanging was ever a deterrent, but by removing what most people think is a deterrent, including those who would be carrying out those violent crimes, what it results in is in every single prison across the region being overcrowded with a sizable amount of persons who are awaiting trial for violent crime, including murder.
Okay, let me get a closing comment from KMR Jordan, because she has to leave as well, and I think you may have to leave very soon too, Erluske.
I was supposed, I'm supposed to join another program at 1.
Yes, KMR. Well, we'll finish this program at 1 o'clock today, anyhow.
Yes, thank you so much, David. Yeah, I mean, Earl Bousquet, you're a man I respect, but I don't agree with much of what you said today, especially
you
as
you don't have to, my friend.
I know.
We're having a discussion. So you don't even have to say you disagree. Just say what you had to say.
Yes. Yeah, so I just want to emphasize, I don't agree on the standpoint that I think you are misrepresenting the role of the journalist. And yes,
that's not good, KMR. That is an interpretation. Let us not go there.
You just need to let her speak.
No.
Give me a chance, though.
But you're telling me I'm misrepresenting.
I said, from my opinion, you are misrepresenting the role of a journalist. And the role of a journalist is not to be filtering the news because it is uncomfortable for persons in society to accept what it is. We have a responsibility in that we live in the society as well, and we have to present the good as well as the bad. But in terms of when the bad is happening, I think it is a severe misunderstanding of the role of the media not to report the facts as they are.
What I heard from him was that we focus on the victims. Mm-hmm. We don't do enough investigation of the people who are behind it, what is motivating them to be involved in the criminal behavior. That's what I heard.
But again, I don't think that is a fair comment. I think we have had tremendous reporting, and especially media houses that are interested in getting beyond just the day-to-day tallying of what the event is in terms of looking at the root causes, what is causing this, who is behind it. What we might do is, again, in terms of the responsibility, is not to seem as though we're promoting gang leaders, but certainly we've had enough reporting in terms of who they are, the boys on the block, what is it that is fueling them, what is it that's motivating them in terms of behavior, etc. So I don't think that is exactly a fair comment in terms of what he's saying. And I think it goes back to the question that came, David, via the WhatsApp. You know, we really have to stick to understanding what is the role of journalists and be able to separate that from the PR persons and the political activists. And I think when we get those definitions right, we'll be...
I would like to look at it this way. I think that there is a lot of scope for delving into what is motivating behavior, but that is not the job of the journalist alone. I believe that there's some role for us to play, because we sometimes can help stimulate action by being out there in the community and asking those questions and reflecting to the rest of Barbados and the rest of Caribbean society what the poverty, for instance, and the mistreatment of people, all of these things that come, the poor education, all of these are the things that we already know are contributing to this, the what is happening in the home. And that has been exposed by us.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could do better than we have, but it then also requires state action. Mm-hmm. To a large extent. You need your sociologists and your psychologists and you're a criminologist, and I do support the idea, because here in Barbados, this situation here of this truce being negotiated, so we've been told, mm-hmm. by somebody who has been a recognized leader of gangs over the years, but having been able to get in there and apparently get them to come to a position. And if he has really been able to achieve that, that's a significant achievement that he's been able to get. But what it does say to us, you cannot rely on the police alone, nor the lawyers alone, nor the courts alone, and that we have been fighting this particular battle in a particular way, and we have been losing the battle. So that's how I would interpret what he's been saying. Mm-hmm. I think there's some closing words from Bert. Let me see if Bert's reception has improved in any way.
Are you hearing me now?
Definitely. We said a lot before you could get back to us. So what are your closing thoughts?
Well, continuing on the crime of affair here is that the country is becoming increasingly prosperous and will become even more prosperous when more oil fields come on stream in another few years. To what extent an underclass will emerge if the proceeds of prosperity do not trickle down to the lower classes? That is a concern.
So that brings us to the question of the planning for that, because it's one thing for us to see it coming and then do nothing about it.
Well, we see no evidence of the planning because, as I said earlier, we like as though we're running behind a Mack truck being pulled by oil and gas. Not no fault necessarily on the government. It's just oil and gas is so damn big and is so successful here that the nation and everybody is trying to catch up with oil and gas. So to the extent people fear that, you know, in 10 years' time, if, as you said, proper plans are not put in place, and underclass could develop of have-nots, people who left behind, who missed out on the prosperity and the trickle-downness of oil and gas.
Well, thank you very much, Bert Wilkinson, for being among those joining us today on this edition of Brass Tax Sunday. We also heard from KMR Jordan in Trinidad, and Jovan Johnson, Jamaica, and Earl Buske came in at the end of the program from St. Lucia. My technical operator today has been Etienne Fraser. I'm David Ellis. Do have a great afternoon, but I want to let you know there will be Brass Tax tomorrow, bank holiday. And you know what we're going to be discussing? A controversial issue of the child protection legislation, with the whole objective of trying the best that we can to explain exactly what this particular legislation is setting out to do and to give you a better appreciation and understanding of what it is saying. Bye for now.